From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump is expected to make an appearance at the Environmental Protection Agency to publicly sign executive orders aimed at rolling back much of former President Obama's clean energy plans. NPR correspondent, Jeff Brady covers the energy industry. Hi, Jeff.
Hey there.
I was at NBC years ago. Old habits. This is about the regulation of carbon dioxide emissions from existing fossil fuel-powered electricity plants. So explain what Trump's plans are and how they're different from President Obama's.
Yeah, there are a few things he can do right off, sort of on his own. He can lift this moratorium on new leases for coal mining on public land. And that is something that President Obama put in place during his administration. But, you know, something that's going to be a lot more difficult is changing the Clean Power Plan. And that's really the center of what we're talking about here, because that is going to be way more complicated. It was developed through lengthy processes, you know, proposals, public comments, considering those comments and then changing the proposal based on the comments and making sure it abides by existing laws like the Clean Air Act. You can't just make that all go away. You have to unwind it in a very similar process, because someone can come along and say, this doesn't comply with the law, and take you to court and drag this whole process out further. So what we're seeing today, this rebooting of U.S. climate and energy policy that President Trump is putting in place, it's a process that could drag out for a few years.
Well, more broadly, the Trump administration has talked about getting the EPA back to what it says it's its original or core mission, protecting the environment, protecting human health. Of course, backers of President Obama's plan would say that's exactly what his clean energy plan was. But where are we on Donald Trump's thinking? And before you answer that, we have, of course, heard from others in his administration. Here's President Trump's budget director, Mick Mulvaney, speaking just last week.
Regarding the question as to climate change, I think the president was fairly straightforward. We're not spending money on that anymore. We consider that to be a waste of your money.
Well, and is that, what does that say to you about the president's stance on fighting climate change?
It says to me that it sounds like the administration wants the EPA to get out of the climate change business. There's one big problem with that. The Supreme Court ruled about a decade back that greenhouse gases can be regulated under the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Power Plan from President Obama's administration was designed to do exactly that. We don't know exactly what the Trump administration wants to do now. And you've got these sort of squishy beliefs about climate change that we're hearing from different people in the administration. It's a little difficult to pin them down. Some will acknowledge that climate change exists, but they're still kind of introducing uncertainty, you know, about the extent of climate change and what policies are best to address it.
Even though the preponderance of all the science there, of course, says that there is. And there's also debate about how it's caused, but not in much of the science field. So,
exactly.
So at the time when the president was campaigning, when he made prioritizing coal miners a huge point, he said that was part of rolling back some of these regulations, getting jobs for them. So talk about the coal industry. How has it changed in recent years? And is that a realistic goal, jobs?
Bringing back coal jobs, it has a lot more to do with environmental regulations. There have been technology improvements in this field, just like every other field. A lot of the work has been mechanized. You don't need the same number of people to operate a coal mine that you used to. But on the other side, on the environment side of things, the technology really hasn't kept up. This industry has been talking about clean coal for a long time, but it just hasn't lived up to the industry's expectations. And they'll say, well, all the federal dollars have been going to researching renewable energy. And I think you're going to start seeing a push for some of those research dollars to go toward making burning coal cleaner.
Yeah, even though the market might determine where the dollars go, you know, if people in the market feel that it should go the other way. But just very briefly, we only have a half a minute. What does this mean for the Paris climate talks?
So a senior White House official was asked specifically about that during a briefing with reporters, and there's nothing specifically about that in what the president is going to do today. He said that whether or not the U.S. will stay in the Paris climate deal, that's still under discussion.
NPR's national correspondent, Jeff Brady. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump has promised to deport 2 to 3 million people who are in this country illegally right away. In order to do that, the government would first have to detain those people. And as Julie Small of Here and Now contributor KQED reports, the government could do that by opening tens of thousands of detention beds, many of which are in California.
The pre-dawn arrest of a 27-year-old Guatemalan man named McGeeber happened so quickly, his wife Gibieres says their three children slept through it. She was washing dishes when someone knocked on her kitchen window. Eris says the two men in her driveway identified themselves as police.
And they said to us, "We're investigating a case of hit and run."
The men asked to see registration papers for her husband's car.
So he went out, he opened the car up, and he got the registration out. And then the man came up behind him, and I saw that he showed him a paper. And that's when my husband said, "Yibi, it's immigration."
The ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, took McGeeber to a county jail in Richmond, California, where the agency has a contract to detain up to 318 people. Lisa Knox with Centro Legal de la Raza has asked that we only use McGeeber's first name while his case is pending. She thinks ICE detained her client because of a recent arrest for reckless driving.
He was working three jobs, just caring for his family. He made one mistake, and suddenly immigration's knocking down his door at 5 a.m.
Instead of prioritizing violent criminals for deportation, President Trump is prioritizing anyone who violates U.S. immigration laws. Jessica Vaughn with the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank that favors restricting immigration, says Trump's making the right move.
I think the executive orders that he has released so far are right on target and were needed in order to restore some integrity to our immigration system.
ICE would not comment about plans to expand detention, but an analysis of public records shows the agency could find space to detain an additional 20,000 people virtually overnight. Some of them could end up here in California, where ICE locked up 5,300 immigrants last year. Many, like McGeeber, could go to jails run by municipal governments in counties that rely on extra income each year from ICE.
At the moment, it's probably around $2 million.
Sheriff David Livingston oversees the jail where McGeeber's being held.
That money goes to defray the costs of running the jail and reduce the operating costs of the taxpayers of Contra Costa County.
ICE could contract more jail beds throughout the country, but in California, the inmate population has recently dropped by 9,000 due to new laws that mean fewer people get incarcerated, so there are beds available. Private prison companies have 17,000 more beds to offer nationwide in states including Alabama, Colorado, Louisiana, and Texas. On a call with investors last month, Damon Heiniger, the president of CoreCivic, which owns and manages private prisons, said ICE detention is driving up profits.
Should ICE have additional needs, we are well positioned to deliver safe, humane, and cost-effective solutions.
But Denise Gilman, who runs the immigration clinic at the University of Texas Law School, warns about the conditions in private prisons and says their focus is keeping costs low.
And they do that by skimping on food, on health care, on mental health care, and anything else so that they can maximize their profits.
A federal investigation of the Adelanto Correctional Facility in San Bernardino, for example, found delays in health care, shoddy record keeping, and failures to properly report sexual assaults. The operator, Geo Group, has since nearly doubled the size of the prison. Mary Small with Detention Watch Network, a nonprofit that advocates for alternatives to incarceration, believes ICE is spending more than the $2.5 billion Congress budgeted for detention this year. But that won't be a problem for ICE.
For the entirety of the Obama administration, Congress gave ICE more money than the president asked for in the president's budget. And so there's a real willingness to throw large amounts of money at locking immigrants up.
The Center for Immigration Studies' Jessica Vaughn acknowledges detaining more people will drive costs up, but thinks it will pay off.
When people get the message that you're not necessarily home free if you make it to the United States, I think it's pretty clear that fewer people are going to try to come here illegally.
Back in Oakland, McGeeber's children eagerly wait for his call from jail. 8-year-old Kevin is snacking on peanut butter on toast when the phone rings.
Hola, papi. aquí en la casa. Sí. Bien.
McGeeber's wife, GB, is struggling to support the family.
Pues no, dejé de trabajar porque...
I stopped working because my oldest son had an operation and I had to take care of him. But now I have to look for other ways to survive.
An immigration judge scheduled a hearing for tomorrow. McGeeber's attorney asked ICE to release him until there's a final decision in his case. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Small.
Corey Stamper is a rock star lexicographer and editor at Merriam-Webster with a Facebook fan club. Her Ask the Editor videos have thousands of views. Let's listen to the plural of octopus.
So let's say you're swimming in the ocean and you see some eight-legged cephalopods. You say to your friend, hey, I saw a group of octopuses. And your friend says, hey, you're an ignorant slob. You saw a group of octopi. So is it octopuses or octopi?
Well, it turns out it's both. Now she has a book, Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries, an occasionally profane behind-the-scenes look at writing one. Corey Stamper joins us from WHYY. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Robin. I'm glad to be here.
How did this all start for you? You write about how you were a pretty good student, but nothing, you know, at five you weren't reading the dictionary. And then suddenly there was this, I think it was a German class, or was it Old Norse?
It was a class on the Old Norse Icelandic family sagas, which, you know, is about as nerdy as you can get. And our professor was explaining how to say this word, and he said there's an odd sound at the end of this name that is called the voiceless alveolar lateral fricative. And I lit up like a used car lot. I thought, I don't know what that is. Fricative, that sounds obscene. Lateral, that means you can aim it. Voiceless, but you say it. So that's the thing that really hooked me on language itself, not just story, not just words, but language.
Yeah. You went on to study Old English and really just dive down, as you say, this rabbit hole. And in fact, you say, I was from that point on a woman obsessed. I traced words across the rough sword and buckler of Old English over the sibilant seesaw of Middle English. You go on to say, I discovered that nice used to mean lewd, stew used to mean whorehouse. I hadn't just fallen down this rabbit hole. I saw it in the distance, ran full tilt at it. The more I learned, the more I fell in love with this wild, vibrant whore of a language. What? Why? Why would you characterize it that way?
Well, English as a language has been stealing words from other languages pretty much since its inception. When we first started speaking the ancestor language of English, which is Old English, we were already stealing words from Latin. We were stealing words from Old Norse. In the, you know, high Middle Ages, we were stealing lots of French words, and we started stealing Italian words. We've just always been a language that kind of sleeps around, and and that's fine, and that's what makes English so beautiful and wonderful and also so frustrating for people who are trying to learn English as either their native language or as a foreign language. I have so much empathy and sympathy for people who are trying to learn English as a foreign language.
Now, you say something in the book that I felt when I started to read it. I thought words were already defined.
Right. Lots of people do. When I tell people what I do for a living, a lot of people say, well, we already have the dictionary. Why do you need to write another one? But old words take on new meanings all the time, and new words come in all the time. And, you know, you got to have somebody who's paying attention to that.
So give us some examples, just some things that you had to wrestle with. Take, thinking offhand, well, the definition of that would be. And then I try. Then I'm spacing because I can't, even though I know the word.
Right. And the thing is the definition of take depends on how you're using it, what its context is. So taking the bus is different than taking the witness stand, is different than taking a number, is different than taking a flyer. So all of those takes have to get cataloged. And the way that lexicographers have always done it is to kind of, we look at all of the accumulated written evidence we have for that word, and then we sort them into piles. It used to be paper piles, now it's electronic piles, based on meaning. And once you start doing that, it gets really difficult to pull something apart and say, okay, I'm going to say that take the witness stand is different from taking the bus. So how is that different? Well, do you step up onto it? Is that the sort of core of the meaning? Well, no. When you take the witness stand, you're being entered into an official record. Okay. Is that really it? When you take the bus, do you get on the bus? Do you get in the bus?
Would you steal it?
Yeah, you steal it. You steal the bus. That's what you do.
Well, you know, being inside your head while you do this, I can see how you describe it as coming upon doors that just go out into air and stairs that go nowhere.
Yeah, it really is. You hit a point with, I think, most particularly long entries where you just feel like, I don't speak English anymore. These words don't make any sense to me. I have no idea what they mean. They're in some weird low German dialect. I don't know what I'm doing. It is a really brain-wrenching exercise.
That's Corey Stamper, one of the editors at Merriam-Webster, in her new book, Word by Word. She talks about the secret life of dictionaries. And I mentioned, often scatologically, is that how a lexicographer who has to be so careful with the words that you're putting in a dictionary, is that how you kind of let loose?
Maybe a little bit. I actually let loose by I collect weird words that I find when I'm proofreading dictionaries, which is a task I would wish on nobody.
We love and weird words. Can you?
They're great.
Give us a few.
One of my favorites is gardiloo, which is defined in one of our dictionaries as a warning cry used in Edinburgh when throwing slops out the window.
Right. We have to talk about irregardless. Sadly, yes. Because that makes your skin crawl and mine too. But you were tasked with responding to an angry email when it was included in the Dictionary One version. And your first response when you got the email was, that's ridiculous, and explain why you were sure it wouldn't be in the dictionary.
To me, irregardless is just flat out wrong, because that's what I had been told my entire life.
Take us through it. Ear?
Ear. So that's taken from the word irrespective. And regardless is regardless. So it's a blend of irrespective and regardless. And it means regardless.
Right. People really mean to say regardless of what happened. But why is it in the dictionary?
Because, if you can believe it, this word that everybody has this very specific and vehement dislike of gets used in print a ton. It ends up in edited prose way more than you would think. And it goes back to the late 1700s, I think, is where we've dated it at this point. And I think it actually originated as an emphatic way to say regardless. So yeah. People would say, well, regardless of that and irregardless of the other thing. And that just kind of got flattened when it got into print.
Well, and talk about reader response. I mean, this was one of the cases, and I think you say the spectrum of hatred of irregardless might be unmatched. I mean, you know, what you hear from people when you have to explain why it's in the dictionary, even though you also hate it. And you say that you were prepared for this kind of exchange because once, as a bakery assistant, an angry customer picked up an Elmo cake and threw it at your head. And so you were prepared for this. But really, can anything prepare you for how people feel about words?
No, it really can't. People feel so deeply about language. Language is very personal for people. And so words like irregardless, people see them as a personal affront.
Yeah. Well, lots of hard work, lots of tedious work noticed by people who love words when it rubs them the wrong way. But then in 2009, there came this. Here's a little excerpt from the Stephen Colbert Show.
Now, I recently learned that Merriam-Webster's has changed the definition of marriage. It now includes the state of being united to a person of the same sex in a relationship like that of a traditional marriage. That means gay marriage. You know, I'm beginning to suspect that Merriam and Webster were conjugating more than just irregular verbs.
This, of course, was the old Stephen Colbert, the fictional conservative character. But this came at a tough time for you. You'd been the focus of a writing campaign. You happened to be the editor who was assigned a response to the inclusion of gay marriage in the marriage listing. What was that like?
It was rough. This was one of these instances where people feel strongly about language because language is a cultural marker. And their concern was that the dictionary is supposed to be an arbiter of language. Language is what expresses our culture. Therefore, the dictionary must be an arbiter of culture. And if you're going to enter this, then, you know, the Supreme Court will refer to it and the world is just going to fall apart and Noah Webster is spinning in his grave. And it was about 3 solid weeks of email. And it was very rough. And because I had to say, we're not describing the thing, marriage. We're describing a use of the word marriage. And that seems like, you know, hair splitting to a lot of people, but that's what lexicography is. We deal with words, not culture, fortunately for everybody around us, because we're all really awkward nerds.
How awkward is it? You know, you love words. You'd rather sit with words than, it sounds like, just about anything. You've interrupted dinners to take cell phone pictures of the menu for citation files.
I have. My kids hate it.
So how awkward is it, and what's the love?
Inside the office, we find it very collegial and very normal, and people who visit find it very weird because it's a whole bunch of people sitting in cubicles, very quiet, not talking to each other. But, you know, everyone who works there and everyone who does lexicography really does it because it's this beautiful puzzle, and you can't do this work and not love English somehow. Otherwise, it would just drive you insane because it's so tedious and so detail-oriented. But we really all sort of have this strong affection for this language that a lot of people feel is really unlovely and unlovable.
Corey Stamper, lexicographer at Merriam-Webster. Her new book is Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries. Corey, give me another word that you just like that we may never have heard of.
Hootamaganzi.
No.
It's a word for a hooded merganser, which is a kind of duck. And now you know.
Yeah, and now you know. Corey, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
I knew that. No, I did not. Hootamaganzer, what's your favorite? A word that just you think nobody's heard. Let us know. hereandnow.org.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks. Chicago is reeling from another weekend of gun violence. 3 dead, 29 wounded in shootings. And a new study out today says one of the factors behind Chicago's violence epidemic is segregation. The Chicago area is one of the most segregated in the country, both racially and economically. Marisa Navarra is vice president at Metropolitan Planning Council, which partnered with the Urban Institute on the study. She joins us from Chicago. And Marisa, what were some of the most striking things that you found in this study about the impacts of segregation?
One of the things we really set out trying to understand better, and that I think did come back very strikingly, was what is the impact to everyone in this region? I think typically when we've talked about segregation, we talk only about the negative impacts to low-income people of color. And that's really left a big part of our region feeling that segregation is not their problem and that they don't need to be part of the solution. This report really changes that narrative and shows that there are direct impacts that hit everyone. And we see that in things like educational attainment, where we see that 83,000 bachelor's degrees, those would be for African Americans and whites. In fact, the bigger impact would be for whites. In that instance, we also see that the drop in homicides, that impacts everyone. And our report really amplifies all the ripple effects of that, as well as increased income for African Americans. There's lots of ripple effects, including, you know, $8 billion to our GDP. So I think what's interesting for us in this report is that we're really for the first time able to quantify the impacts to everyone in our region.
And why is segregation such a problem for all of those issues, for the economy, for violence, for education? What is it about people being segregated that causes these problems?
So this is a study that really looks at what? You know, this is a study of correlation, which doesn't tell us as clearly as we'd like why we see relationships. It tells us that those relationships exist. Now, clearly, there's things that we know that segregation has caused problems over history. And we know that many of those patterns, even though laws have changed, we know that many of those patterns persist into the present day. So it's one of the things we're moving to in our next phase of this project, which is really the what do we do about it?
And we should say, by the way, that the other regions on the list that are actually more segregated than Chicago are Philadelphia, Bridgeport, Connecticut, New York, and Milwaukee. Have there been any regions that you've seen that have been successful at desegregating?
Yes, we looked at several regions that fall right near the median and that have similar population demographics as Chicago. So it was important to us that the regions had similar proportions of white, African American, Latino. The three I would pull out would be Houston, Atlanta, and Raleigh-Durham. Atlanta in particular, over the same period of time from 1990 to 2010, where Chicago moved from 8th to 10th most segregated, Atlanta went from 21st to 41st. So in our next phase of work, one of the things we'll be very interested in doing is trying to understand what happened in Atlanta. What are the things that can be done to really make the kinds of changes that they were able to make during that time frame? To me, what's hopeful about this story when we look back over our history, we created the segregation that we have. It didn't happen organically. It was deliberate. What that means is we can be just as deliberate to undo it.
That's Marisa Navarra, who is vice president at Metropolitan Planning Council in Chicago. She co-authored a new study on the impact of segregation on regions. Marisa, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll link you to that study at our website, hereandnow.org.
When President Trump signed his executive order banning travel from seven majority Muslim countries back in January, one family in Portland, Maine was watching every development with concern. They'd just arrived 3 days earlier from Iraq, and now they waited, wondering if they'd ever see the daughter they'd left behind. To them, her very life was at stake. Erica Lance from Here and Now contributor Kind World has our story.
Labid al-Hanafi sits on a wooden chair with his eyes closed while he strums the oud. Years ago, he would play the stringed instrument for U.S. troops in northern Iraq when he served as an interpreter. Back then, he knew his work for the United States made him and his family targets for terrorists.
Because U.S. troops were considered by the terrorists invaders. The locals who worked with them considered as betrayals. And they were very simply slaughtered.
Iraqis who helped the U.S. were indeed seen as traitors to be slaughtered. In fact, Labid says two of his neighbors, who worked with the U.S. in Baghdad, were killed. One night, when Labid came home,
I saw a kind of posters stuck on my door, and it says, "The devils of U.S. that betray our nation and they should be punished." And drops of blood and knives. That was the first time for me that I felt that myself and my family were very close to be killed.
We expected that they might come in any second.
That's Bana, Labid's 20-year-old daughter. Labid applied for a special visa for Iraqis who had worked with the U.S. military. Finally, in late 2016, their visas arrived, and Labid's family could immigrate to the U.S. There was one problem. The visa for Bana was missing. It had been held up for some reason. Labid and his wife came to the difficult conclusion that it was too dangerous to wait in Iraq. So they and their two younger daughters fled their home in the middle of the night to travel to Portland, Maine, where Labid's brother lived. Bana stayed behind with her grandparents.
It was like everyone was crying, and it was scary because I didn't have the choice to leave the house.
Bana hid in her grandparents' home and worked on travel arrangements. And then,
"We only want to admit those into our country who will support our country and love deeply our people."
President Trump's executive order banned Iraqi citizens from traveling to the U.S.
So I went to Facebook and it was like everyone was talking about it. And I started to call them saying, "Is that true? Is that fake news or something?"
Bana didn't know what would happen to her. She was confused and scared, and Labid knew they needed help. So back in the U.S., he walked to the office of the local newspaper, the Portland Press-Herald, and told his story. It made the front page, and that got the attention of Adam Burke, a 37-year-old community organizer.
"I live in Portland, Maine."
And Brian Eng, a real estate developer in his 40s.
"I saw Adam Burke repost the article on Facebook. Labid had served our country. sort of on a patriotic level, I was upset by that. And then as a parent, I was emotionally reacting to the idea that, you know, you could be separated from your child in this way.
Brian had only met Adam once, but they were Facebook friends.
I put a comment on his post, "Let's figure this out. I'll buy the plane tickets."
The next night, Adam and Brian met Labid and his brother, and they all started to plan.
I probably sent, I don't know how many hundreds of emails and text messages.
Adam and Brian assembled a team of Portlanders who wanted to help and enlisted a lawyer who told them that a judge had blocked Trump's order for Boston. For the first time since the ban was signed, Labid felt optimistic.
It seemed to be like a hope or a light at the end of the tunnel.
But things were about to get complicated. For one, airlines were reluctant to fly Iraqis like Bana.
You know, we had been talking about private planes, ships, going to Canada.
The answer multiple times was no, that nobody was going to put her on a plane.
The team knew that every day, Baghdad became more dangerous for Bana. And that ruling by the judge in Boston would only last a week.
The whole week was very terrifying. I didn't know what to do. Nobody knew what to do.
Finally, the team found an airline, Lufthansa, that would take Bana. They booked flights for the next morning, February 2nd, while President Trump's ban was still blocked.
So the plan was to meet at Becky's Diner at 5 a.m., kind of our command central to deal with problems as they arose. Before we even got there, we found that Bana couldn't get on the plane.
So with just hours to go and Bana waiting at the airport, Brian got back online. And after some frantic searching, he booked a new itinerary for Bana that very day. She would fly from Baghdad to Doha to Istanbul to Frankfurt to Boston, each connection with its own hurdles.
It was tense. I don't remember breathing very much while we sat there.
Finally, they got word that Bana was on her last flight, and they all drove to a mobbed Logan airport.
The first person to come out who was affected by the ban was Bana.
20-year-old Bana Al-Hanfi arrived in the United States today.
I hugged my mom first, and my father, and my sisters, and
the family that she'd feared she'd never see again.
It was very emotional because people I've never saw in my life, never talked to, they helped me to come here, and very, very amazing. I learned from them, like, helping others is the feeling of being a human. All I wish is I can do the same in return to all the people in the country.
Bana plans to start college, and the end of this story is really a beginning. For Adam?
I've started going to community meetups to learn Arabic with my son.
And for Brian as well.
For me, the gift of this whole experience has been to get to know this family and feel like I'm part of their story now.
Labid never expected that a group of strangers from a country he'd lived in for just 3 days would do so much. But now, he says, they're connected permanently.
Here is our home, and these are our family. Our destiny is like their destiny, and this is it.
For Here and Now, I'm Erica Lantz.
So, it's official. Las Vegas is getting a football team. Yesterday, NFL owners voted to relocate the Oakland Raiders to Las Vegas. Kevin Bollinger is sports director at the Fox 5 Vegas. He's in Phoenix, where the NFL is hosting meetings today. Kevin, what's been the response in Vegas?
Oh, there's a ton of excitement in Las Vegas. You know, for a city that has so many different entertainment options, the one thing we didn't have was the NFL city, which is a different type of stamp. People are looking for everything that brings, not only with the NFL team, but by building the new stadium for the Raiders, it's going to open up a lot more entertainment options for even the non-sports fan as well.
Well, so that's great for people in Las Vegas who put on shows and things, but people aren't so sure this is good for the sport. As you know, the Oakland Raiders are trading the country's number 6 market, at least in television, the Bay Area, with all the revenue television brings, for the Las Vegas market that is kind of in the bottom with something like 758,000 TV homes. But that also implies 758,000 homes. I mean, that's a much smaller city. Do you think you're going to find the fan base that a team needs in that kind of a small amount of families?
What people need to realize is there's about 2.3 million people in the metropolitan area of Las Vegas. It's not even going to be the smallest NFL city out there. Plus, they feel they're going to, A, draw a large number of season ticket holders from Southern California, which is about a 4-hour drive, And from a tourist standpoint, they know that people are going to come for the visiting team as well, who are going to make a weekend of it, come to Las Vegas and go see their team.
Well, here's a question asked by USA Today. The last time Los Angeles had two NFL teams, that was in 1994, they ranked 24th and 28th out of 28 teams when it came to attendance, the amount of people coming. So I guess you're saying you're betting on them going to Las Vegas and adding a few more things in for the weekend game.
Yeah, I think that that was part of the plan, that they were counting on the tourist part. Las Vegas obviously bases a lot of their economy on tourists coming in for various things. And the question will be, can they continue that long term over not only a series of years, but a series of decades, especially if the team, say, struggles. Right now the Raiders are playing good football and they're a playoff team. If they do go into a lull, will the fans still show up? And I think that's a struggle that any NFL city has outside of a certain few that will sell out no matter what.
That's Kevin Bollinger of Fox 5 News in Las Vegas, that city absorbing the notion that it's got a football team coming its way. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you.
This comment from Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has raised some eyebrows. He was speaking last week at a forum led by Mike Allen of Axios and was asked about artificial intelligence and its impact on jobs.
In terms of artificial intelligence taking over American jobs, I think we're like so far away from that not even on my radar screen.
How far away?
Far enough that it's...
Seven more years?
Seven more years. I think it's 50 or 100 more years.
50 or 100 more years. Mnuchin's response earned silence from the room and shock from Silicon Valley. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of policy and politics at Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us more about the response to Mnuchin's comments.
Well, you're absolutely right. A lot of folks were left raising their eyebrows at the Treasury Secretary's remarks about artificial intelligence. This idea that it could be 50 to 100 years shocked a lot of folks in Silicon Valley who have been pouring billions of dollars of research into AI, and to labor experts who have studied this field for a long time. There are plenty of studies out there that show that AI could start to hit the U.S. economy in as few as 10, 20 years, perhaps even within the course of the Trump administration, in changing the way that industries and factories work. So it was sort of surprising to hear someone in the U.S. government say that it was so far on the horizon.
Well, and he did clarify that he saw a difference between artificial intelligence and robotics. What exactly is that difference?
Yeah, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin sort of tried to walk it back and say that robots had taken some U.S. jobs, but robots are part of this general AI field. I mean, AI is a pretty big, broad term that applies to everything from things like self-driving cars and drones that deliver packages on their own to, supercomputers like IBM's Watson that apply very high-powered algorithms to sift through large data sets and find things like disease-spreading patterns. It's a very, very big field, but plenty of the data out there show that the effects of artificial intelligence are already being felt and will be felt very soon within our lifetimes. Just look at some of the data out by PwC, which put out a report just this week that found, by the 2030s or so, about 38% of U.S. jobs are at risk of being touched or affected or disrupted by artificial intelligence. And those jobs weren't just low-wage jobs, the sort of things that we normally might think about in U.S. factories and manufacturing facilities. The PwC report was also talking about the financial services industry. It's everything from the making of cars to the, examination of medical records to, much higher paying jobs like the financial services industry that could very much be disrupted by this field.
To the driving of cars as well. And by the way, also anybody who's gone through a supermarket checkout line recently knows that often the person is not there with you anymore. You just do it yourself with a computer and driving through a toll booth in many cases doesn't exist anymore. It's all done automatically. So a lot of jobs have already gone away.
Yeah, self-driving cars is a big one. Self-driving trucks in particular, we could see some great disruption. There were some studies put out by MIT just within the past few months that polled some experts who said they really felt within the next two decades, we maybe wouldn't see the trucking industry look the way it does right now, that self-driving trucks would largely replace the folks who are driving them manually. Now, that being said, there are a lot of challenges, right? Self-driving cars are very hard to implement, and companies like Google and Uber have faced some difficulty in bringing bringing those things to life. So it's not like AI is this, you know, very easy to do, check the box exercise when it comes to technology. But we're already seeing instances where robots are replacing humans at some jobs. There's more money going into this field. And so it's, you know, reason to think that 50 to 100 years is a bit of a long time horizon.
Well, let's say that Steven Mnuchin had the opposite view and said this is a real problem and we need to do something about it now. What exactly can you do about AI replacing human jobs?
Well, you know, if Secretary Mnuchin had said it was a problem now, he might have come down closer to where the Obama administration was just about a year or so ago when the White House, under the former president, embarked on a whole review of artificial intelligence and some of the problems it could potentially pose to the U.S. economy. But, you know, even Mnuchin himself sketched out a few ideas as to what the U.S. government could do. He talked a lot about training, about taking those folks who are affected by the rise of AI, who might be out of work, who may not have to pursue the careers of they're currently pursuing, and getting them back into the workforce in different and potentially higher paying U.S. jobs. That being said, that's not easy to do either. Government has to create programs. It has to spend money. That gets Capitol Hill involved. The politics of doing these things are sometimes about as hard as the technology in Silicon Valley. But, you know, Mnuchin did sketch out a pathway to get there, but it really all does involve, you know, more education and potentially more spending by the U.S. government.
And it sounds like it also involves AI is going to take these jobs. You've just got to find another job.
AI potentially is going to take these jobs, and folks may have to consider, you know, pursuing different career paths if that's ultimately the case. And, you know, that being said, I think the Mnuchin situation points to another issue in Washington, and that's this question about what lawmakers and what federal officials do and do not know about technology. Hmm. You know, we constantly hear this from Silicon Valley that folks in the U.S. government just, you know, maybe don't understand enough about the trends in the technology sector. You know, Secretary Mnuchin seems to know a bit about technology. I'm not doubting his expertise here, but I think a lot of folks in the Valley walked away from this thinking, you know, hey, maybe this is an example, yeah, that perhaps there needs to be more education done, because there will be policy challenges.
Well,
and there will be political challenges too.
We got to leave it right there. Tony Rahm, thank you.
Thanks for having me.